I wanted to start with a famous song that you may or may not have heard of. It may actually be really old. I don't know if it's really old or really new. You guys can let me know about that. I'm only going to play the chorus. It's on the loudest. It's only my phone, but it's a small room and there aren't that many of us. So I'm going to play it now. Just try to listen to the words. If you don't get them, I'll repeat them.
Mama Rock will cry for us again. Won't you shed a tear for your dear children? If you raise your sweet voice now as then, the day will come. Mama Rock will cry for us again. Won't you shed a tear for your dear children? Is it good day?
Did you guys hear the words? Okay, I'll just repeat it again just in case. Mama Rach will cry for us again. Won't you shed a tear for your dear children? If you raise your sweet voice now as then, the day will come. And the question that I wanted to start off this year with was why, especially today on the occasion of Rachel Aminu's Yahrzeit, which we're actually commemorating this Shabbos on Yud Aleph Cheshvan, do we ask Rachel Imenu to cry for us again, or Mama Rachel, depending on your language, right? Why do we ask Rachel to cry for us again? And why specifically today, right? To raise her sweet voice now as then. And as you might have guessed, as you were listening to the song, if you have read already what is in source number one, this is really an allusion to what Yirmiyahu tells us in his Nevuah, in his Sefer, in Perek Lamed Aleph. Very, very famous psukim, in which begin with the words "Kol b'Rama Nishma." Right? A voice was heard in Ramah, which is generally understood as a city in the Nachala, in the portion of Binyamin, one of Rachel's children. And that voice is of Rachel crying. She's crying because her children are being taken into exile by the Babylonians, and she refuses to be comforted. She cannot be comforted, which actually echoes the same idea of Yaakov when he heard that Yosef, or when he thought that Yosef was killed, he also refused to be comforted. Now, I think it's Rav Sabata who points out that it's possibly, potentially for the same reason, because as Rashi points out, the reason why Yaakov couldn't be comforted was because really Yosef was still alive. So he couldn't be comforted because really there was no closure. It wasn't really, he wasn't really gone, so he couldn't be comforted because it wasn't ever going to end. And so perhaps even in that very phrase, we can derive comfort that the reason why she's crying is because they're going out into Galut, but there's hope within that phrase that means that it's not going to be permanent, that really there is going to be a resolution and that her children will return, which as in the very next pasuk, Hashem does promise, in the next two pasukim, Hashem does promise her, v'yesh tikvah la'achritik, there is hope, you know, for the end, v'shavu v'anim l'gvulam, and your children will in fact return to their land. And the question that I would like to ask on these psukim is, why Rachel? Right, we've heard this psukim many, many times. We've heard this song, we might have heard Simple Liner song, right? We know that Rachel cried for her children as they were exiled, but she was not the only aim, she was not our only matriarch. Why Rachel specifically? Out of all the four imahot, we have Sarah, we have Rivka, we have Rachel and Leah, why specifically is it Rachel who's crying out for the plight of her children? Why is she the one davening to Hashem? In attempting to answer this very question, I think it's Rav Maidan who points this out, which is, I thought, extremely insightful as to, you know, what brought Chazal to say what they say. But in attempting to answer this question, Chazal noticed that this is not the only time in Tanakh that Rachel is singled out, is set apart from the rest of the Imahot. This is not even the first instance. This is the second instance in which we see Rachel separate from Sarah, Rivka, and Leah. The first instance in which Rachel is separated from her fellow matriarchs in Tanakh is in her burial site. We all know that where are most of the Avot and Imahot buried? In Ma'arah HaMachpelah, in Hebron. But where is Rachel buried? Right. So if you turn to the cover page of your source sheet if you want, she's buried in what is known now as Kever Rachel. She has her own burial place. Which, if you might have, I don't know if I gave you the source, I think I did, right, when she died in childbirth with Binyamin, they were on their way, they were traveling toward Hebron, but they were not yet there. And Yaakov buried her where he was, baderech, on the way. We have to pay attention to that word because that word is going to come up again. Rachel is buried baderech. In the midst of the journey, they did not go any quicker? You know, there and there's a very big question as to why she was even buried there. And in connecting these two examples, these two instances in which Rachel is really separated from the rest of the Imahot, Chazal really paint this beautiful scene, which you have seen, you know, it's made very, very famous by Rashi, and you guys, if you prepared, read those Rashis, in which the people of Bnei Yisrael, well, really, let's start back. The reason why Yaakov buried Rachel, not with everyone else in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, but specifically on the way to Beit Lechem, is because he knew that centuries from then, when the people were exiled and being led, excuse me, by the Babylonians, sorry, can I just ask for a water? When Bnei Yisrael were being led by the Babylonians to Babel, sorry, I'm just going to wait. I had salty stuff for dinner and I had 1,000 gallons of water, but it never helps. Thank you, Tanya. I really appreciate it. Sorry. Hashem knew that they would pass by the location, the site of Kever Rachel, and the people would be able to daven to Rachel and ask her for help because they were leaving their land. They didn't know what life would be like without the Beit HaMikdash, without Hashem living in their midst. They had no idea what it would be like. We can't imagine that because we know everything about Judaism without the Beit HaMikdash. For us, it would be almost different. It would be shocking to live a life with the Beit HaMikdash, but for them, it was the opposite. There had never been a Judaism, a national land in Judaism, and they had never experienced a Judaism without it. And so they beseeched Rachel to help them. And we're told in the next Rashi that what does Rachel do? She approaches Hashem after all the Avot and other Imahot attempted to and failed. And how does Rachel muster up the courage, and how does she really muster up Hashem's Rachamim? She reminds him of the time that Lavan switched, her father switched her sister with her, replaced her with her sister when she was supposed to marry Yaakov, and it ended up being Leah. And even though Rachel wanted to marry Yaakov, she loved him too. She felt, and this is the rest of the song, you can listen to it at home, it's Mama Rachel by Ibi Rodenberg. She gave over the simanim, the signs that she and Yaakov had planned in anticipation of this trick by Laban, to make sure, to test it out, to make sure that it was indeed Rachel. And instead of leading her sister to shame before Yaakov, she transmitted these simanim. And Rachel says to Hashem, Hashem, I had rachamim, and I allowed my rival, right? Another wife is considered a tzara, a rival, because they cause a lot of tension often. Right? I allowed my rival into my own home, and yet I still had rachamim on her. Hashem, yes, I understand. Bnei Yisrael allowed your rival into your own home, right? They worshipped idols in the Beit HaMikdash. But your rachamim is greater than mine. And that's what clinched it. And that's what enabled Hashem to say, you know what? Yesh sachar lefulateich. There's reward for your deeds, for your actions. You are going to be rewarded, and ultimately, v'shavu v'adim l'gvulam. Right? Rachel was able to arouse Hashem's mercy through her own story. And Hashem therefore promised that the people would actually return. This is a beautiful, like I said, the Medrash really paints a beautiful portrait and ingeniously connects the two instances in which Rachel was really separated from the rest of the Imahot. She was buried separately, she cries for Bnei Yisrael on her own, and the Medrash really connects the two. But the reason why she was buried separately was so that she could call out for Bnei Yisrael on her own. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful Midrash. And that's likely why it really became so famous, and it's really what we often think about when we approach Rachel's Yurt site, if we're aware of it. We often think about her as, you know, the quintessential mother davening on our behalf, and that's why going to Kever Rachel is a very emotional experience for many of us. And yet there's another approach that I would like to focus on for the rest of the night, and though it's much, much less famous than the Midrash that many of us have heard of before, it still does shed light on the two instances in which Rachel stands apart from the rest of her fellow Imahot, both in her death, where she's buried, and in her afterlife, where she davened on our behalf. This approach really views the connection between these two instances from a more shot-oriented perspective. And it's adapted from an article by Rabbanit Sharon Rimon, I assume, not Sharon, I assume she's Israeli, I think she is. Rabbanit Sharon Rimon, that I found on VBM, which I thought was extremely, extremely insightful. And so the question that I want to pose to you, who have learned the sources, is what were Rachel's primary struggles during her lifetime? In reviewing the Prakim, what were some of her primary struggles? She did not have such a simple life. Very good. Right. The major, major struggle was her barrenness, right? A struggle towards motherhood. Is there any other struggle that anyone noted? Yeah. Marriage, right? There are two primary struggles that Rachel had to deal with. There was marriage on the one hand and motherhood on the other hand. The first, we'll just go in chronological order, right? Marriage, and many of us view this as more of Yaakov's issue, right? Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel and then he got switched up. But did any of us ever stop to think, well, Rachel also was building up in anticipation for 7 years? Can you imagine? Right? Some of us may have known our, you know, significant others for 7 years plus before we got married to them. Many of us did not. 7 years is a long, long time to wait. And she did, and every day the anticipation got, you know, larger and larger, and she got more and more and more excited. And then the time finally comes, and her father searches it up. Now, you could say, okay, but she never gave up Yaakov's love. Yaakov always loved her more. However, which I thought was really interesting, Rabbi Rimon pointed out, that was the only thing she still had. In everything else, she was now the second wife. She now had the tension that comes from being the second wife, especially when the first wife is your own sister, the tension that lasted throughout their entire relationship, although I will say that according to her Hirsch, they did reconcile and have a beautiful relationship towards the end. Also, just the very idea, certainly she was second in terms of being the mother to his children. We know that Leah is the one who had 7 children of Yaakov's, and Rachel had to wait and wait and wait until she finally had 2 of her own. Even in her place of burial, as we discussed, she was his second wife, right? His primary wife was buried next to him, Leah. And so we see that other than the Ahava, which, believe me, is strong, and I'm not trying to negate it at all, but what's interesting is that we very often overlook the fact that Rachel really had to become tier two in making this decision to allow her sister to marry her beloved, in making the decision that her sister's shame, or preventing her sister's shame, was much more important to her than her own primary wifehood in the house of Yaakov. So that was her first struggle, very important struggle. The second, more primary struggle, perhaps the one that really resonates with us, is, and the one that we associate with Rachel Imenu, was a struggle toward motherhood, the struggle with infertility that Rachel experienced for many, many, many years. Ultimately, she was, thank God, blessed with 2 sons, and yet she died in childbirth so that she really could not raise them. And so even though, Baruch Hashem, when she finally conceived, she did finally conceive twice, even that dream wasn't fully realized because she wasn't able to raise them as their mother. And the Torah really sheds light. It really gives us a glimpse into how did Rachel deal with this second torturous struggle. Right? For those of you who saw it inside, what were Rachel's mechanisms through which she tried to deal with her ordeal? What did she do? What were the steps she took to kind of come to grips with it and try to overcome the hurdle that she had, her barrenness? Yeah.
She followed Sarah's model.
Good. Very good. She definitely followed Sarah's model in that?
She gave her maidservant.
Very good. She gave her maidservant to her husband. And even before, right before that step, what does she do? Before she says, okay, Yaakov, here's Bilha, what does she do? You remember? She goes to Yaakov and says something to him. What does she say? Good. Havali banim v'im ayin meta anochi. Give me children. I'm going to die if I don't have children. She's desperate. All she wants is a child. And she turns to her husband and says, give one to me. And what's Yaakov's response? Atachar alokim anochi? Am I God? Last time I checked, I was human and I can't make you pregnant. I'm sorry. I am not in the place of God. And this is an extremely important point to realize, that Rachel's first attempt to become pregnant was to try to get Yaakov to help her. As opposed to her sister Leah, who recognized that Hashem was a part, an integral part, of the fertility process, in the sense that she thanked Hashem for every single child she had with, you know, in her naming ritual. You know, instead of learning from her aunt, Rivka, who, according to Rashi, davened alongside Yitzhak, four children. But according to the text, even, as soon as she became pregnant, something was going on. She turned to God to see what was going on. And of course, her husband's grandmother, Sarah, as we'll see in a moment, also recognized that God is part of the process. Right? And we'll see that inside in a moment. But as opposed to those other three imahot, this is the third instance in which Rachel sets herself apart. For some reason, at least here, she does not recognize readily that Hashem is a part of the process of having children. She approaches Yaakov instead of God. So that's the first step that she takes in her, you know, in trying to overcome this hurdle and trying to become pregnant. What we might have expected from Rachel, once she receives this rebuke from Yaakov, Hatachar Elokim Anochi, I'm not God. What might we have expected his wife to do then? To daven, to turn to God, to say, Hashem, please help me. But instead, the second step is exactly that which Vivian noted. Instead of saying, okay, Hashem, please help me, she says, okay, Yaakov, here's Bilhah. I will be built up through her. Which, as Vivian noted, is exactly what Sarah did. Yet Rabbanit Rimon noticed something, again, very, very, very interesting. If we turn, actually, because I don't think I had you guys look in the source, in source number 7 at the back of the booklet, we're told that Sarai had an Egyptian maidservant. In Pasuk Bet, Vatomer Sarai al Avram, Hine na asarani Hashem miladet. Hashem has prevented me from giving birth. Hashem has prevented me from conceiving a child. Sarai acknowledges from the get-go that Hashem is involved in the process. Rachel makes no such acknowledgement. She says, I can't have kids, but she never mentions that Hashem is a part of the process. What's her next step? Bona el shivchati ulai ivana minana. So Yaakov, please, here's my maidservant, and perhaps I will be built through her. As Rabbi Rimon notes, this perhaps implies or really reveals her faith. Maybe Hashem wants it, maybe not. It's all in his hands. Whereas Rachel says it with certainty, I will be built up through Bilhah. Almost taking Hashem's will out of the picture. I want it, so it will happen. So Rachel's first step is to turn to Yaakov. When he gives a rebuke that he's not God, instead of turning to God, she turns to Bilhah. It seems that instead of turning towards Hashem, Rachel is kind of seeking these pragmatic solutions, these more practical solutions, even though they may not have practically worked so well. She was trying to find some way of conceiving without actually turning to the source of conception. And yet, while this attempt did succeed in giving Rachel two children through her maidservant, it did not succeed in enabling her to conceive her own children. Some of the Parshanim say that maybe the reason why Sarai and Rachel gave, and ultimately Leah, gave their maidservants to their husbands is that through the zchut of kind of sacrificing themselves and giving their maidservant to their husband, they would conceive. And yet, for Rachel, and with Leah it did happen, but with Rachel it did not. And so then comes the famous story of the Dudaim, the third pragmatic step, and possibly not so smart step that Rachel took, was to kind of trade Yaakov, having Yaakov for the night, for these Dudaim, for these flowers that in ancient times were believed to have powers of fertility. Again, we know that being with your husband is a much surer way to become pregnant than these flowers, okay? And yet Rachel was so desperate, her mind wasn't really thinking straight. Again, she was focusing on the pragmatic. She was focusing on, what can I do, what can I do? She was literally desperate. And Rabbanit Rimon points out that in her first three attempts to become pregnant, she was turning away from the ultimate source. She was not really approaching God. She didn't really fully understand the power of tefillah. And so right after the Dudaim episode, we see Leah becoming pregnant instead of Rachel. After she finds that she's barren, she has two sons, she has a daughter. Leah now has 7 children. Rachel has none. And now I will turn your attention to source number 6, Perek Lamed Pasuk Chaf Bet. When Rachel finally does, oh, it's on the same back of the page. When Rachel finally does become pregnant, listen to how the Pasuk explains it. Vayizkor Elokim et Rachel, Vayishma Elaha Elokim. When Hashem finally remembers Rachel to give her a child, what is the reason why he gives her a child? Because he's heard her. She's finally acknowledged that the only way to become pregnant is through tefillah, is through the power of prayer. And it is only through the power of prayer that she was able to finally fulfill her dream of having a child. What's interesting about this entire episode, and actually let's even take that a step further, is that not only was her tefillah answered, finally when she davened, she was answered, but in her naming of Yosef, she demonstrates that she really internalized the lesson. Because in her naming of Yosef, she includes a tefillah as well. She names him Yosef, Ki Asaf Hashem et Charpati, because now Hashem has gathered my shame, I'm no longer childless. But also the name has an additional meaning, Hashem Yosefli Ben Acher. Hashem, please give me another child. Right? And so we see that Rachel, who struggled with the idea of tefillah, it wasn't her. It wasn't something that she gravitated toward. Even when she was rebuked by her husband, it wasn't something that she naturally decided to do. And yet, through her struggles and through attempting and failing many times, she finally recognized that tefillah, that the power of prayer, is what was going to do it. So Rabbani Rimon suggests that perhaps this is why, this is how we can answer our original question, perhaps this is why Rachel is the one who is held apart from the other imahot in her burial place, and also the one who is held apart from the other imahot in davening for her children as they are taken into exile. As Rabbani Rimon explains, sometimes when it's very hard for us to achieve something, when we're working really hard towards a goal and we're exerting so much effort, once we finally achieve it, we appreciate it, we value it so much more. To give a very current example, I was texting with my brother during the Game 7 of the World Series, and my brother, who lives in New York, and he was a diehard Yankees fan, but they were all rooting for the Cubs because we live here. We're all rooting for them. And as we were texting, maybe right after they won, I said something like, "I can't believe it." And my brother texted back, "My son is 8 years old, okay? We moved here when he was 5, so he's been a Cub fan for exactly 3 years." And my brother said, "I just kind of wish he had suffered a little bit more so he'd appreciate it a little bit more." Right? It's like really easy to become a Cubs fan in 2013. You know, but the idea that if we suffer through something, if we work hard at something, if we put our all into something, we really do, I mean, we can all think of examples from our personal lives, you know, even more important than the Cubs, that we really do appreciate the value of something that much more when it's harder for us to get it, right? When something is rare, when it's hard to find, it rises in value. That those are the laws of economics. That's the law of human nature as well. And so what Rabbani Rimon suggests is that it was through this struggle with parenthood that enabled her to be almost the penultimate aim, right? The mother with the, you know, everyone imagines her with this big embrace, embracing her children, because she really, really understood, even more than the other imahot who were also akarot, but she really understood the struggle and therefore the value of having children. And even more than that, Rabbani Rimon suggests, is her struggle with tefillah. The idea that Rachel, tefillah did not come easily to her. It wasn't natural. She really struggled with this idea of talking to a God she couldn't see, of not hearing his response. It wasn't something that spoke to her. And I'm sure there are some of us in this room who have the same struggles. It's really hard to feel like our cries are falling on deaf ears because we don't hear a response. We're not Nevi'im. We don't know what Hashem is saying back to us. We can try to interpret what's going on in our lives, but we don't know for sure. That's a struggle, a very, very real one. And Rabbani Rimon suggests that because Rachel struggled so much with that concept, with that idea, that in order to get something, in order to have a relationship with Hashem, we have to work at it, we have to daven, she so completely internalized that message that not only was she the penultimate mother, but she was also the penultimate prayer, right? One who prays. And so because of that, perhaps, she received the zuchut of being Rachel Nevaka Abaneha, the one aim who is able to daven for her children, right, even after she has passed from this world. How does this all connect to her being singled out for burial? Because we said that, I suggested in the beginning that Rabbani Rimon connects this to her burial place, Baderech, the fact that she was buried on the way in the journey. How does this all connect? This is an amazing insight, I think. Rabbani Rimon suggests that it's because it's not only about her burial place being Baderech, but Rachel's entire life represents a journey, a process. Rachel's entire life was done by Derek. How so? Remember, we spoke about her two primary struggles, marriage and motherhood. Both of those struggles, says Ravanit Rimon, were processes that never reached a conclusion. She waited 7 years to become Yaakov's wife, in the primary sense of the term, and never made it there. She waited years and years and years, we don't even know how many, to become the mother of his children. And yes, she did give birth to two children, but then she died in childbirth and was never able to realize her dream of raising her children, of being a mother in the sense of motherhood. And so what Ravanit Rimon explains is that Rachel represents the importance of the process. That even when we put so much energy into something, when we have these dreams that we want to realize, even if at the end of the day we don't have the ability to realize them, we don't have the ability to bring all of our goals to fruition, sometimes that's okay. Because very often, it's not the end that is the most important, but rather the means to the end. It's appreciating the journey for what it is. The idea that the journey itself can strengthen us and can help us realize our potential, even more so than the achievement of our goals. This is what Rachel represents. Rachel represents the idea that, you know, the famous quote that life is a journey, not a destination. It's not only about where we want to end up. It's about how we're going to get there. So even though Rachel was not able, unfortunately, to realize her dream of being Yaakov's primary wife, she wasn't able to realize her dream of raising her children to become members of Am Yisrael. It was the journey that she undertook to get there, that strength that she derived, that she learned from her struggles, the idea that, and Ravanit Rimon suggests that this very idea that Rachel represents the journey and the process itself, that's why she was singled out to be the aid who was Nevaka Abanah. How so? Because as her children were walking towards, or being taken, I should say, towards Bavel, and they passed her kever, that reminded, that just being at her kever reminded Bnei Israel that exile may not be the end. It may not be the conclusion of our relationship with Hashem. Rather, it may just be, as Rachel herself symbolizes, one small step in our journey. We all think, and certainly then they thought, Gullet, this is the end of the world. There is no way Judaism can survive outside of Eretz Yisrael. They didn't know anything outside of Eretz Yisrael. And yet, the idea that they were able to pass by Kibbutz Rachel on their way out, the fact that Rachel was there, that served to remind them, to teach them, that what they're experiencing now is part of the process. It hasn't reached its conclusion. Their relationship with Hashem has not ended. There's one small blip on the road, but as Rachel can teach us, it's not just, right, it's not only about the end. It's about what we do when we get there. And primarily, it's about connecting with Hashem along that road. During our journey, during that process, through which we're struggling and trying to figure it all out, what's going to help us? Keva Rachel reminded Bnei Yisrael on their way to Babel that the key to success, the key to connection with Hashem, even outside Eretz Yisrael, is the power of prayer. It's the continuation of tefillah. And I believe that today, as we commemorate Rachel's Yahrzeit on Shabbos, this lesson is a lesson that we would do so well, all of us, to remember ourselves. That life is not about the destination, right? It's about the journey. The fact that we're here in wonderful Chicago and not in Eretz Yisrael, the fact that the Beit HaMikdash is not here yet, that's okay, because it can come. It will come. As long as we recognize that Gullet is not the end, we have not, thank God, I think we've proven that Judaism still survives and even thrives in Gullet, and the idea that tefillah is the key to keeping up our connection to Hashem. As Hashem promised Rachel herself, Yesh tikva la'acharitech, there is yet hope for your future because you've used the power of tefillah, because you represent the process. Vishavu vanim begulam, and your children will return to their borders. Thank you so much for coming. This was